Hi, I'm Glenn Gallagher, and welcome to World Governments Explained. Each episode, I'll choose a different country and explain how its political system works in less than an hour. It's that simple. Last episode, we focused on the United States of America. If you haven't listened to that one yet, don't worry. You can keep listening to this episode now and check out other episodes at any time. The episodes of World Governments Explained are not serialized, so feel free to listen to them in any order you want. In this episode, we're going to focus on the United Kingdom. Before we go into any specifics about how the UK's political system works, I want to pause for a second and highlight what I mean when I say the word government in this episode. Generally speaking, the term government can have two meanings, and depending on what country you're in, they can refer to two different things. In some places, government is used as a generic term to refer to all of the systems and structures with the official power to govern in society. But in the United Kingdom, that's not how they use the word government. Instead, the government in the United Kingdom is a specific part of the political system that holds executive power. What this means is that the UK government is a group of about 120 people who run the United Kingdom on a day-to-day basis by developing and implementing policies. Because of that distinction, for the rest of this episode, I'm going to refer to the United Kingdom's overarching governing institutions as its political system, and I'll use the term government to talk about that specific group that holds executive power. Sorry, I know that's a slow way to kick off the episode, but it's important to clarify to avoid confusion, especially for listeners who aren't familiar with UK politics. But with that out of the way, let's get started on how the United Kingdom's political system works. I hear people talk about what's going on in the United Kingdom a lot, and oftentimes, I hear terms like England, Great Britain, and the United Kingdom being used interchangeably, and they're actually all different. So first off, what exactly is the United Kingdom? And how is it different from England and Great Britain? Let's go through each of them to understand what they are and how they're different. First up, we have England. For where we're at right now in the episode, the most important thing to know about England is that it is a single country. That's it. That's all you need to know about England at this point. I'll expand on it more later in the episode, but for now, just remember that England is one country. Next up is Great Britain. And Great Britain is an island in the North Atlantic Ocean where three countries are located. And those three countries are England, Scotland, and Wales. So when people say Great Britain, they're referring to the countries of England, Scotland, and Wales as a group. Notice that England is part of Great Britain, but you can't use the two terms interchangeably because Great Britain also includes Scotland and Wales. Finally, we get to the focus of this episode, which is the United Kingdom. And the United Kingdom is a political union between four countries. And those four countries are England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. The key difference between the United Kingdom and Great Britain is that the United Kingdom includes Northern Ireland and Great Britain doesn't. Make sense? Good. Now, I know I said in the intro that in each episode I'd choose a different country and explain how its political system works. But from what I just said, it sounds like by selecting the United Kingdom, I actually pick four different countries for this one episode, which isn't wrong. But I promise, I'm not trying to trick you by cramming all four countries into one episode. You see, it's impossible to look at the political systems in England, Scotland, Wales, or Northern Ireland without considering them all together. That's because, like I said earlier, they are in a political union, and through that political union, they share a common political system. So what kind of political system do they have? When you think about politics in the United Kingdom, the first things that probably come to mind are titles and positions, like the Queen, the Prime Minister, Lords, and Members of Parliament. But trying to understand how these different elements fit together can feel confusing, because at first glance, they seem to be in conflict with each other. When I think back to what I learned in history classes, when countries had a queen or a king, that person was usually in charge of everything, and the kings and queens I remember didn't normally have elected officials running parts of the country. While that's true if we look back far enough into history, it's not how things work in the United Kingdom today. That's because over time, the United Kingdom has transitioned from a traditional monarchy, where the king or queen has all the political power, into a more democratic system, where the people get representation in politics. So where does that leave us with the type of political system in the United Kingdom today? I'll cut to the chase because I've been talking around it for a bit. The United Kingdom is what's known as a unitary parliamentary democracy under a constitutional monarchy. Let me repeat that because it's a bit of a mouthful. The UK's political system is a unitary parliamentary democracy under a constitutional monarchy. Let's break down each part of that to understand what it means. First, it's unitary because, well, a unitary state is one where a single national governing body has political power over the smaller local governments. The local governments in a unitary state carry out the directives of the national government, but they don't act independently or have inherent political authority. Instead, all of their power is delegated from the national level. In the UK, political authority sits with Parliament and the government, which have power over the various local governments in Scotland, Wales, England, and Northern Ireland. I like to think about the interactions between a unitary state and its local governments as being similar to the relationship between the landlord of an apartment building and their tenants. The landlord owns the building and ultimately has control over what goes on in it, like whether to get central air conditioning installed, when to get a new roof, and they can even decide when to accept or evict tenants. But once a tenant signs a lease, they get some control over the apartment they rent from the landlord, like how it's furnished and how hot or cold they keep their thermostat. So just like how the landlord controls the big things in the apartment building that affect all of the tenants, Parliament and the government control the big political decisions that affect England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. And just like how individual tenants get control over what goes on in the apartment they rent, the local governments in those countries regulate themselves on certain issues, and their power to do that is delegated by Parliament. So that's why the UK's political system is unitary. Moving on, the UK is a parliamentary democracy because through democratic elections, the people of England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland vote for individuals to represent them in Parliament. Whichever political party gets the most representation in Parliament as a result of the democratic elections, that party forms the government and makes important decisions that affect all of UK society. We'll get into more details on all of this in a bit, but for now, just remember that the people elect individuals to represent them in Parliament, and some of those representatives form the government and make executive decisions for how to run the UK, which is why it's a parliamentary democracy. Finally, the United Kingdom is a constitutional monarchy. A constitutional monarchy is when a non-elected monarch functions as the head of state within the limits of a constitution. In the United Kingdom, the monarch is also referred to as the crown, and the position is currently held by Queen Elizabeth II. What the monarch and other elected representatives are allowed to do is established in the constitution. Unlike some nations, the United Kingdom's constitution is uncodified, meaning it's not written out neatly into a single document. Instead, the UK constitution is based on past legislation and precedent. I want to call out one point before we move on. Since I'm defining the UK's political system as a unitary parliamentary democracy under a constitutional monarchy, it implies that the monarch sits at the very top and has the most power, which doesn't quite tell the full story. While the UK is certainly structured as a monarchy, the Crown's powers in UK politics are mostly ceremonial at this point. The monarch's formal powers and privileges are called the royal prerogative, although today, these powers are usually exercised on the advice of the government or by members of the government. What this means is that the Crown doesn't actually have a lot of political power. At least, they don't exercise their power. Instead, the Crown remains politically neutral, and their role in politics is to make the decisions of Parliament and the government official. Now that we know the United Kingdom is a unitary parliamentary democracy under a constitutional monarchy, let's look at how it actually works in the real world. And we'll start by considering the three types of power in a political system. First, there's legislative power, which is the ability to pass laws. The second type of political power is executive power, which is the authority to carry out or execute the laws. And finally, there's judicial power, which is how laws get interpreted and applied to real-world scenarios. In some countries, these three powers are separated by assigning them to different groups in the political system and then creating a system of checks and balances to prevent those groups from abusing their power. In the United Kingdom, though, that's not how things work. While the judicial powers are largely kept independent, the other two types of power, so executive and legislative powers, are not separated, and there are not many checks and balances between them. That's because instead of aiming for a strict separation of powers, the United Kingdom has opted for more of a compromise, where some representatives have overlapping responsibilities in the legislature and the executive. Let's go through each part of the UK's political system to understand which groups hold these powers and how they're used. And we'll start with the legislature, which is also called Parliament. I mentioned Parliament a few times already, but just to recap, Parliament's main role is to make laws in the United Kingdom. And Parliament is made up of three parts, which are the Crown, the House of Commons, and the House of Lords. As I mentioned earlier, the Crown's political powers are largely ceremonial, so while they're technically part of the lawmaking process, the real power to make laws sits with the House of Commons and House of Lords. The House of Commons has the most authority in Parliament, and it consists of 650 elected representatives, known as Members of Parliament or MPs. Each of the 650 MPs represents a different region of the United Kingdom called a constituency, and they serve 5-year terms. Meaning that every 5 years, all 650 MPs are up for re-election. Sometimes elections occur sooner than 5 years if Parliament gets dissolved early, which just means that there can be an early election. We'll get into when and why early elections happen later in the episode, but for now, it's not important. So that's the House of Commons. The other House of Parliament is called the House of Lords, and it consists of about 800 members who were referred to as either lords or peers. Unlike MPs, the lords are not elected by the UK people. Instead, lords get their positions in one of three ways. First, there are life peers, who make up a majority of the House of Lords. Life peers are appointed by the Crown, usually at the recommendation of either the Prime Minister or an independent advisory board. Life peers typically get appointed for expertise in their field or profession, and unsurprisingly, they serve life terms in the House of Lords. The second type of lords are called hereditary peers. There are currently 92 hereditary peers, and they also serve life terms. In the past, there used to be more hereditary peers who inherited their title through noble birth. In 1999, though, reforms in the House of Lords reduced the number of hereditary peers to 92. Since being born into a position in Parliament was seen as undemocratic. Now, if a hereditary peer dies, other hereditary peers vote for a noble to replace them. And that's how hereditary peers get their position in the House of Lords. Finally, there's a small section of the House of Lords known as the Lords Spiritual. These are 26 of the most senior bishops and archbishops in the Church of England. And those are the two Houses of Parliament, and their main role is to make laws. But how do they actually do that? Remember how I said that there is not a strict separation of powers in the United Kingdom? Well, this is where it comes into play. That's because the legislative and executive powers are very closely intertwined. Some people who sit in the House of Commons and the House of Lords who make the laws are also part of the government and have executive power to run the United Kingdom by developing proposals for new laws and implementing policies once the laws get passed. So before we dive into the logistics of how Parliament passes laws, I want to shift focus to the government so we can understand where the ideas for new laws actually come from. At a very high level, it works like this. First, the UK people vote to elect representatives in the House of Commons. Some MPs and lords from the political party that wins a majority of seats in the House of Commons form the government, where they use their executive power to decide on which policies they want to implement. Once the government develops its policies, it uses its influence in the House of Commons and the House of Lords to pass laws that support those policies. Finally, After Parliament passes laws to support the policies, the government puts the policies into effect in the real world. That's about the most zoomed out overview I can possibly give for how the UK legislature and executive work. And there's obviously a lot more to it than that. So to understand them in more detail, let's begin with how MPs and Lords from Parliament end up in the government. And to do that, we need to look at how general elections work in the United Kingdom. Whenever there's a general election, all 650 seats in the House of Commons get vacated, and the people vote to elect new members of Parliament. Each candidate who runs for a seat in the House of Commons is affiliated with a political party. The two main political parties in the United Kingdom are the Conservative Party and the Labour Party. So whenever the results of a general election are finalized, usually either the Conservative Party or the Labour Party will win a majority of seats in the House of Commons. When that happens, the leader of that political party becomes the Prime Minister, which makes them the head of the government. Okay, so technically, the Crown appoints the Prime Minister, but their selection for who to appoint is guided by the strict tradition that the Prime Minister should be the person who is most likely to be able to command the confidence of the House of Commons to serve as Prime Minister and to form a government. Sorry, I know that sounds a bit complicated, but that's the official wording for how the Crown appoints a Prime Minister. To put it simply, what this means is that the Prime Minister is the Member of Parliament who leads the political party with a majority of seats in the House of Commons. If no party wins an absolute majority in a general election, then the political parties can try to form a coalition, which is like an alliance between two or more political parties in order to get a combined majority of seats in the House of Commons. If a coalition is formed, the leader of the largest political party in the coalition becomes the Prime Minister. This actually happened in 2017, when the Conservative Party won the most seats in the House of Commons in the general election, but failed to obtain an absolute majority. So the Conservative Party formed a coalition with the Democratic Unionist Party of Northern Ireland in order to get a combined majority. And Theresa May, the leader of the Conservative Party, became the Prime Minister. I want to call out an important point here, and that is, the people of the UK don't vote directly for their Prime Minister. Instead, each political party selects a leader, then UK citizens vote for an MP to represent their constituency in the House of Commons, and whichever political party's candidates win a majority of the seats in the House of Commons, that party's leader becomes Prime Minister. So when people vote in a general election in the UK, what they're really voting for is the party they want to lead the nation. And while they don't vote directly for their Prime Minister, at the time of a general election, the voters do know the leaders of each political party, so they can factor that into their decision when they vote. Okay, now, once the Prime Minister gets appointed by the Crown, they become the head of the government. I want to highlight that since the Prime Minister is also a member of Parliament in the House of Commons, that means they're part of both the legislature and the executive. This is what I touched on earlier when I said that there was not a strict separation of legislative and executive powers in the UK, and that some people have overlapping responsibilities in those two branches. So what can the Prime Minister do with their powers? And how do other MPs and Lords end up in the government? One of the first things a Prime Minister does once they're appointed is to form a government by selecting members of their political party from the House of Commons and the House of Lords to become what are known as ministers. In reality, the Prime Minister recommends ministers for the Crown to appoint, since the power to appoint ministers officially sits with the Crown. But the Crown always appoints whoever the Prime Minister recommends. Anyways, the Prime Minister chooses approximately 120 MPs and Lords to be ministers. The most senior ministers are called Secretaries of State, and there are about 20 of them. Secretaries of State are in charge of government departments, which provide public services to all of UK society. Examples of government departments include Her Majesty's Treasury, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, the Home Office, and the Ministry of Defense, to name a few. Secretaries of State also serve alongside the Prime Minister as members of the Cabinet, which is the highest decision-making group in the UK. The Prime Minister is considered first among equals with the other Cabinet members, which doesn't really make a ton of sense. but essentially, it means that the prime minister can define their relationship with the other cabinet members however they want, as long as the other cabinet members are willing to accept it. The cabinet meets once per week, and it's the group that ultimately decides which policies to implement and how to implement them. The other 100 or so ministers are considered junior ministers. Their official titles are either ministers of state or parliamentary undersecretaries, and their main job is to assist the secretaries of state with the administration of government departments. And that's how the prime minister's power to form a government allows them to influence much of how the UK functions. By selecting people from their political party to be cabinet members and run the various government departments, the prime minister gets to choose who's in charge of the day-to-day administration of the United Kingdom, and they can pick people who agree with their policies and who they think will deliver on their vision for how the department should be run. An important consideration when the prime minister selects other ministers is that all ministers must abide by the principles of individual responsibility and collective responsibility. Under individual responsibility, each minister is responsible for their own personal behavior and for the performance of their department. If a government department makes a mistake, then the Secretary of State who runs it is responsible for those mistakes and may need to resign regardless of whether they were involved in the mistake. Talk about taking one for the team. And under collective responsibility, all ministers are equally responsible for all decisions of the government. A minister can't disagree with the government's decisions and remain a member of that government. If they disagree, they have to resign. So, for example, if a minister didn't agree with the decision for the UK to leave the European Union, then they couldn't remain in government while plans for Brexit were being developed and implemented. That's why we saw so many ministers resign over Brexit. What follows from collective responsibility is that in the future, a minister should not claim that they didn't support a government policy that was agreed on while they were a member of the government. Essentially, if you're a minister, it's ride or die with the government. Just so we're super clear, the prime minister and the roughly 120 ministers they appoint are the government. Once they're appointed, the government is formed, and their next order of business is to make decisions about what policies to implement, then introduce ideas for laws that support those policies, and finally, to put the policies into effect in UK society. So how do they do that? Well, they get help from the civil service. The civil service is made up of over 500,000 bureaucrats who work to provide public services in the UK, such as paying benefits and pensions, running employment services, and issuing driver's licenses. Unlike ministers in the government, members of the civil service are politically neutral, and they don't change as a result of general elections. Instead, their job is to help the government of the day to develop and implement its policies as effectively as possible, no matter which party is in charge. Basically, they want to move the UK forward efficiently, regardless of who's in power. So how do the government and the civil service work together? First, the government, led by the cabinet, comes up with the policies it wants to implement. The civil service advises the prime minister and other cabinet ministers as they develop these policies, because civil servants are experts in various fields, while ministers are career politicians and may not have a lot of experience in the department they run. Major policies are also spelled out in the political party's manifesto, which is a publication issued by the party before a general election that contains the set of policies the party stands for and would wish to implement if elected. Once the government establishes the policies it wants to implement, they're sent to the civil service, who comes up with proposals for new laws to support those policies, and these proposals are called bills. The bills are then given back to the government ministers, who introduce them in Parliament, since again, ministers also sit in the House of Commons and the House of Lords. Once Parliament passes a bill, it becomes a law, and the government presents the law to the civil service to put it into effect in UK society. And that covers most of how the government and the civil service interact with each other. Now we know where the ideas for most laws come from. The prime minister and their political appointees develop policies, and with the help of the civil service, come up with proposals for new laws to support those policies. There is another way that ideas for laws can be decided, and that is when the decision is put in the hands of the people by holding a referendum. National referendums are essentially a vote by UK citizens on whether to adopt or reject a certain policy proposal. The most famous was the Brexit referendum in 2016, in which voters were asked whether the UK should remain in the European Union or leave it. The referendum resulted in 51.9% of the votes cast in favor of leaving the EU, which initiated the Brexit process. Referendums are generally rare, but as we saw in 2016, they can have huge consequences. Now that we know where the ideas for laws come from, it's time to come back to what we touched on earlier, which is, how does Parliament actually pass laws? And we'll get into that after this short break. Welcome back to World Governments Explained. In this episode, I'm explaining how the United Kingdom's political system works. Before the break, we talked about which countries are part of the United Kingdom and the type of political system it has. We also discussed Parliament, which has the power to make laws, and the government, which develops policies and proposes ideas for new laws. Next up, we'll discuss how laws actually get passed. At a very high level, in order for a law to get passed, both the House of Commons and the House of Lords need to agree on a law, and both of them need to vote to approve the law. But in reality, it's not as straightforward as it sounds, and there are some exceptions to that rule as well. Like I mentioned earlier, proposals for new laws are called bills, and bills primarily come from the government. The logic there is that the government represents the political party with a majority of seats in the House of Commons. Since a simple majority vote is required to pass a bill, it's relatively easy for the government to pass bills in the House of Commons, because MPs normally vote along party lines. There are two main categories of bills, which are public bills and private bills. Public bills are the most common type of bills and deal with matters that affect all of UK society, such as immigration, trade, defense, or the logistics of how the UK will leave the European Union. And private bills deal with issues that affect a smaller number of people. For example, a private bill may deal with a local authority seeking the right to build a bridge or a road. There's also a third type of bill, called a private member's bill, which is really just a public bill, but one that gets introduced by someone in Parliament who is not a minister in the government. But private member bills are less common, so we won't spend time on those. Now, before a bill becomes a law, it goes through a lot of steps where the details of what should be included in the bill get debated and challenged. But in the simplest terms, a bill can become a law in one of two ways. The most common method is when a bill gets proposed in the House of Commons. Before a bill is introduced in Parliament, a lot of prep work is done to get the bill drafted and ready. This is the work done by the government and the civil service, which I talked about before the break. First, a green paper is issued to give a list of potential policy options. Green papers are pretty vague and are really just meant to start the conversation about the bill in Parliament. Once that happens, Parliament will consult with the relevant parties most likely to be affected by the bill, such as citizens or trade unions. After these consultations are finished and everyone's opinions are considered, then a white paper is issued. The white paper narrows down the broad list of policy options from the green paper into a more focused policy proposal. Usually, an early version of the bill is included with the white paper. At this point, the bill is ready to be presented to the House of Commons for the first time, in what's known as the first reading. The first reading is just a step to formally introduce the bill to the MPs. There is no debate or vote on the bill at this stage. A few weeks after the first reading comes the second reading. In the second reading, the MPs debate the general principles of the bill, and then they vote to determine if the bill should move forward on its path to becoming a law. If a majority of MPs vote to approve the bill in the second reading, then the next step is the committee stage. In the committee stage, a committee of Parliament reviews each clause in the bill in detail and may make amendments to it. Parliamentary committees are small groups within Parliament that specialize on different policy areas. So, if a bill is related to national defense, for example, it would get reviewed by the Defense Select Committee. There are other parliamentary committees that deal with bills pertaining to business, education, foreign affairs, and other areas. Once a bill gets through the committee stage, it moves on to the report stage. The report stage takes place on the floor of the House of Commons, and all MPs can propose amendments to the bill. Once all MPs have had the opportunity to propose amendments to the bill, it moves on to the third reading. By this point, though, the principles of the bill were already debated in the second reading, and the committee has combed through it in detail, so there usually isn't a lot of debate. If a majority of MPs vote to approve the bill in the third reading, then it clears the House of Commons and gets sent to the House of Lords. In the House of Lords, the same review and approval process happens, where the Lords will do a first reading, second reading, committee stage, report stage, and third reading. If the House of Lords approves the bill without making any amendments to it, then the bill gets sent to the Crown for royal assent. But if the House of Lords does make changes to the bill, then instead of going to the Crown, it gets sent back to the House of Commons, where the process starts over again. If the House of Commons makes additional revisions to the bill after getting it back from the House of Lords, then it goes back to the House of Lords again for another round of review and approval. This back and forth is known as parliamentary ping pong, and it continues until the House of Commons and the House of Lords both vote to approve the same version of the bill. Once that happens, the bill gets sent to the Crown for royal assent. Okay, so that's the first way a bill can become a law. The second way is very similar, only the initial steps in the process are reversed. And that's when the bill is first proposed in the House of Lords. The only difference is that the first reading, second reading, committee stage, report stage, and third reading happen in the House of Lords first, and then it gets sent to the House of Commons before the parliamentary ping-ponging occurs. Just like a bill proposed in the House of Commons, once both houses agree on the same version of the bill, it gets sent to the Crown for royal assent. You may remember earlier how I said that the Crown is part of Parliament and is involved in making laws. That's where royal assent comes in. You see, the Crown is required to give their approval, called royal assent, to any bill before it becomes an act of Parliament, which formally makes it a law. This is a good example of what I said earlier, that the Crown's powers in politics are largely ceremonial. While royal assent seems like it would give the Crown a lot of power in determining which bills become laws, in reality, royal assent is just a stamp of approval that makes the law official. That's because the Crown always gives royal assent. Royal assent has not been refused on a bill since 1708, so over 200 years ago. And that's how laws are passed. In the process I just described, it sounded like the House of Commons and the House of Lords had the same amount of power when passing laws. And while most bills do go through that process, we already know that the House of Commons has more authority than the House of Lords. But why is that? Like I mentioned earlier, lords are not elected by the people of the United Kingdom. Because of this, the House of Lords is often viewed as undemocratic, and as a result, the power of the House of Lords has been reduced over the last 100 years. At the same time, the House of Commons has gained more political authority. The most obvious example of this is that if the House of Commons and House of Lords disagree on a bill, the House of Commons can send a bill for royal assent without approval from the House of Lords by passing the same bill in consecutive years. Basically, what this means is that the House of Lords can delay a bill by 1 year, but they can't block the House of Commons from passing a bill indefinitely. Other examples of how the House of Commons has more power than the House of Lords are that bills certified as money bills, which get passed by the House of Commons, will automatically become law after 1 month, with or without the approval of the House of Lords. A money bill is a bill that is concerned only with national taxation, public money, or loans. Another way is that if a piece of legislation is in a political party's manifesto, then the House of Lords won't block that legislation. This prevents the House of Lords from blocking the will of the people, since legislation in a manifesto sets forth the party's policies prior to a general election. And that's what the UK citizens vote on. The primary role of the House of Lords is really to hold the government accountable and to make sure that the laws being passed are fit for purpose. Once a law gets passed, the government enforces the law, or executes it, by implementing policies allowed by the law into UK society with the help of the civil service. So if the law was to increase unemployment benefits, for example, once the law was passed, the government and the civil service would work out the logistics to actually provide those additional benefits to the people who qualify. It all sounds so simple. Well, maybe not simple, but you may be sitting there wondering, if the government's political party controls a majority of the House of Commons, and they only need a simple majority vote to pass laws, then can't they do whatever they want? They should be able to develop policies and then pass laws to support those policies fairly easily. And the short answer to that is yes, but it's more nuanced than that. The parties that have less than a majority of seats in the House of Commons don't just sit around and wait for government ministers to bring bills to Parliament so that they can get outvoted on them. The smaller political parties do a lot to examine the work of the government and put forward opposing policies. The main way they do that is through Her Majesty's Official Opposition, which is usually just called the Opposition. The party with the second largest number of seats in the House of Commons gets to form the Opposition, and it's done in much of the same way as how the government is formed. The leader of the second largest political party in the Commons becomes the leader of the Opposition, which is sort of like the Prime Minister's counterpart, and MPs and Lords from their party become shadow ministers, thus forming what's known as the shadow cabinet. Like the cabinet ministers in the government, each shadow minister is assigned to a different government department, and their main duty is to scrutinize the government's work for their department and to propose alternative policy options that oppose the policies developed by the government. The opposition's efforts are put on public display when they get to question the prime minister and other government ministers. Each week, the leader of the opposition gets a 30-minute time slot where they can question the prime minister on any topic they want in what's called the Prime Minister's Questions, or PMQs. The PMQs get a lot of media attention because they usually get pretty heated, with the leader of the opposition trying to make the prime minister look bad with their questions. The opposition also gets opportunities to question other ministers about the work of the different government departments. By having these public forums for questions, the opposition party can call attention to things the government is doing that may be questionable or unfavorable in the eye of the public, and it allows them to hold the government ministers accountable for their actions. Since the government is chosen from, accountable to, and operating through Parliament, if as a result of the opposition's efforts, the government loses the support of the House of Commons, then the government can be dissolved through a vote of no confidence. A vote of no confidence needs a simple majority in the House of Commons to pass, and if it does, one of two things happens. Either a new prime minister is appointed if a majority of MPs decide another member of parliament is suitable for the job, or parliament gets dissolved and there is a new general election. This is one way general elections can occur sooner than the 5-year term of parliament. The other is if 2/3 of the MPs in the House of Commons vote for an early election, which starts the whole cycle over. And that wraps up the legislature and the executive. Before we move on to the judiciary, I want to call out a few other powers and responsibilities of the Prime Minister. These are sort of one-off powers that don't fit cleanly into how the UK's political system operates on a day-to-day basis, so I'm just going to list them out here so you're aware of them. The Prime Minister has a weekly audience with the Crown to discuss government matters. During these meetings, the Crown can warn, encourage, and consult the Prime Minister on what's happening in the UK. The Prime Minister can also recommend life peers to be appointed to the House of Lords. They can declare war, including single-handedly authorizing the launch of a nuclear strike. They can sign treaties, and they represent the UK at the highest level in international negotiations. Last but not least, we have the UK judiciary, which interprets the laws and applies them to real-world scenarios. The UK judiciary is actually quite complex, and to better explain how it works, I want to first go back to something I mentioned earlier in the episode, and that is, while Parliament and the government have the power to make laws and policy decisions that affect all of England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland, some responsibilities get delegated by Parliament and are handled separately by the individual countries. This is called devolution, and it's relevant for Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. The only country in the United Kingdom without devolution is England. So why would Parliament do this, and what does it actually mean? Well, devolution puts certain powers in the hands of Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland, so that local factors are better recognized when making decisions. Scotland and Wales each have their own parliament, and Northern Ireland has what's called an assembly. And they're essentially local governing bodies that have some legislative and executive powers within each country's borders over matters not reserved to the UK Parliament. The devolved powers differ between Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland, so we don't have time to go through all of them. But the types of powers devolved by Parliament include health and social care, transportation, agriculture, forestry and fisheries, and some taxation. So why is talking about devolved governments relevant to the UK judiciary? Well, since some powers get devolved to the individual countries, it makes the legal system in the UK more complicated than most nations. Instead of having a single, unified system of law, the United Kingdom has three separate legal systems, one for England and Wales, a second for Scotland, and a third for Northern Ireland. I'm not going to go into the details of each legal system, because honestly, there could be an entire series for that. What I will say is that each of the three legal systems has a separate system of courts that hear criminal cases, civil cases, and family cases. And sitting at the top of all three legal systems is the Supreme Court of the United Kingdom. The Supreme Court was formed in 2009 and consists of 12 judges, called justices. Supreme Court justices are recommended by an independent selection committee and appointed by the Crown on the advice of the Prime Minister and the Lord Chancellor, who's a member of the Cabinet and is responsible for ensuring the courts remain efficient and independent. Once appointed, justices can serve until the mandatory retirement age of 70. Cases appealed in the lower courts of the three legal systems have the potential to be heard by the Supreme Court. A panel of three justices consider written applications to decide if a case raises an arguable point of law that's important to the general public. If it does, then it will be heard by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is the final court of appeals for all civil cases in the United Kingdom and for criminal cases in England, Wales, and Northern Ireland. Criminal cases in Scotland are not heard by the Supreme Court, but instead are handled within Scotland's legal system. Supreme Court cases are heard by a panel of five justices. Sometimes, that number can be increased to 7 or 9 justices if a case is especially complex or important. But there are always an odd number of Supreme Court justices presiding over a case. The Supreme Court also decides devolution matters, which are issues about whether the devolved authorities in Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland have acted within their powers or failed to comply with the laws imposed on them by Parliament. And with that, we've talked through the United Kingdom's political system. What I want to do now is to take a minute and try to bring the episode full circle and tie it all together, because the way the UK political system works is really a lovely little cycle. First, the people of the UK vote for representatives in the House of Commons. The party that wins the most seats in the general election gets to form a government, and MPs and lords from that party become ministers. The ministers run the country by developing policies and then creating bills to support their policies, which they bring back to Parliament to formally pass as laws. And once they pass those laws, they put the policies into effect into the real world with the help of the civil service. While all of this is happening, the smaller political parties question and scrutinize the government's work to hold them accountable, and the laws passed by Parliament get interpreted and applied to real-world scenarios in the three legal systems and by the Supreme Court. With that, we talk through how the UK political system works in less than an hour. I know some of the things we talk through can be confusing, and we move through everything pretty quickly. Plus, some people are visual learners. So to accompany this episode, I've put together a diagram that summarizes everything I explained in the episode. A link to the diagram is available in the episode details or on our website at worldgovs.com. That's worldgovs.com. So if you're interested, please check it out. The website also has more information about the podcast, and links to stream other episodes will be posted when they're available. So thanks for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed this episode of World Governments Explained. Next episode, I'll explain how the political system of France works. Follow or subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts, and get the latest episodes and learn more about other countries' political systems. And if you enjoyed the show, please rate us and leave a review. Have a great week.